You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is late in the evening, July 19th, 2025, and for the 95th time, I've been asked by someone to do something on Vlad the Impaler. It's a lot more than that, but I'm just sounding reasonable. I don't know why I keep forgetting about it. It's kind of like how I never get back to people. It's never personal. It's just how I am. But as always, I've been studying the Balkans as long as I've been studying Russia. Balkans and Wallachia, certainly part of it to some extent. Russia's much easier. The Balkans are always complicated. Wallachia is, of course, no different. Of course, this is pre-Romania, but these are the pieces that will become the United Provinces and eventually Romania in the 19th century. So we're talking very late Middle Ages. We're talking after the fall of Constantinople. You see, Vlad the Impaler is treated as an absolute monster. And somehow, it got into people's heads that he is the actual Dracula. And there is zero evidence for that being the case. It just gives more evidence to the fact that everything that the typical normie thinks about the world is wrong. I'm studying the politics of Wallachia, which is very hard to do, due to its complexity. You see that people like Vlad faced very similar problems as Russian monarchs did. Every society has a choice. Either it's going to move in the direction of a monarchy dedicated to the common good or to an oligarchic free-for-all ruled by a secret, very, very wealthy order of some type or another. The exact same phenomenon is going on here. And we're at a point in history where the Crusades are done. They failed. And it seems that the Holy Lands were firmly in control of the Ottoman Empire. And that Ottoman Empire was expansionist. And if you listen to my show on the Serbian despotate, or read the article on it, you realize a very depressing fact. The Turks were invited in. I hate to admit it, but it's absolutely true. Anybody who had a problem with the current ruling house ran to the Turks and allowed them free passage if they gave him power later on. This happened over and over and over again. And this happened long before the fall of Constantinople. The Turks were invited to Europe by the inability of Christian rulers to A, get their act together, and B, realize what's ahead of them. They completely misjudged and misunderstood what the Turkish Empire was. But still, the European knights were defeated. But they saw one day, maybe, they will still free Jerusalem from the Islamic Turks. Of course, they didn't realize that in 2025, the Turks and people like them will be also invited in by secular governments of the Western world. Also, if you listen to my show on the Despotate, I spoke of the Order of the Dragon. To be a knight there, you had to proclaim a solemn vow to war against the enemies of... It was an ecumenical body. You had Catholics and Orthodox in it. To war against the enemies of Christianity, specifically the Ottoman Turks or Islam. And even there, betrayal was everywhere. It isn't as if the Muslims expanded, you know, took Constantinople and just, you know, this juggernaut that took the Balkans as far up as Vienna. No, you had plenty of people who were working for them. The Jews, there weren't as many Jews in this area as there were, say, in Spain, but you had people working for them, making this much easier. Now, as you all know, the Ottoman Turks came to dominate vaguely what we call the Balkans, Serbia, parts of southern Hungary, parts of Romania, Bulgaria, and Greece. This expansion was stopped at the infamous battle at the gates of Vienna. Vlad the Impaler is within this era. And anything he did that seems distasteful was done because Europe was in serious trouble. Wallachia is not that big. Although it is on the Black Sea, making it very strategic. Now, his father, Vlad II, Romanian voivod, warlord, joined the Order of the Dragon and was given that name, Vlad Dracul. So the Holy Roman Emperor recognized Vlad as a rightful leader of the Romanian region of Wallachia, which by 1436 was under his control, but the Turks were at his doorstep. Other than fight, he betrayed his order. Like so many others, he assisted the Islamic forces in their invasion of Transylvania. Of course, Vlad was rightfully stripped of his right to Wallachia. And that battle provided the Ottoman Sultan with an opportunity. The Order of the Dragon, the main goals were to protect the interests of Christianity in general. Times were desperate. It wasn't as if you could really worry about the fine points of theology here. This is the origin of the term Dracul, or dragon. And that really came from the oligarchs or the boyars of the area calling him that once he was incorporated into the order. Dracula, the son of Dracul, was used by Vlad III, or Vlad the Impaler, in official correspondence. The only thing that really connects, you know, Bram Stoker to this order was a black cape over a red coat, which was worn only on Fridays, especially during Lent, to commemorate the Passion. Now you may ask, why the dragon? That seems to be a non-Christian element. Well, it's more like the order of the Ouroboros, the beast of revelation who is slain by the forces of good. Now, there's no original form of the emblem that survives, but it's been referenced in, you know, art and writing and everything else. So they are the forces that are making war on the dragon. So very similar to the Order of St. George. But its sole purpose was to defend Europe against the Ottoman Turks. Vlad II, Vlad the Impaler's father, was brought into the order in 1431 by Sigismund of Luxembourg, the founder. And again, his name will be erased. Vlad II Drakul personally led the Turks who besieged and burned the Svetin fortress, destroying the Teutonic knights there who were fighting against the Ottoman threat. This is what you had to do when you went over to your enemy's side. And I can't imagine that the Ottomans had any respect for these people. I fully recognize that they were in a difficult position. I can't imagine what that would be like. But you still then were obligated to give them whatever they needed in terms of money or manpower to destroy your own allies and spread Islam throughout the area. Now, the Ottomans eventually conquered the area. Wallachia, and Vlad Dracul was reinstated as ruler, became a vassal state of the Turks. So it was sort of like a buffer zone between the Ottomans and the Holy Roman Empire. But his power was dependent on the Sultan almost entirely. Now, of course, no one really trusts somebody who's going to sell out their own people. So they had to give hostages. And one of those hostages was Vlad III, Vlad the Impaler, Dracula. So he grew up in the court of the Sultan. It's one hell of a life experience, and he was fluent in the language as a result. Now, he had three reigns, which is very typical of the area. Just one, the fall of 1448, then from 1456 to 1462, and another in late 1476. Now, he was a hostage to the Turks from 1442 to 1448. Now, his father, Vlad Dracul, again, obtained the throne of Wallachia only through the Turks. But upon the return of Vladislav of Hungary, now, Vladislav II from the Battle of Kosovo, he was forced to take refuge in Moldova under Bogdan II. That's where he befriended Stephen the Great. He went on a pilgrimage to Transylvania before leaving to defend Belgrade. Him and his allies entrusted Vlad with the defense of southern Transylvania, taking advantage of the situation and having the support of some of the boyars. Vlad managed to occupy the throne in July-August of 1456, before August 20th, when Vladislav was killed. But more importantly, Vlad III Dracula witnessed firsthand. He became an expert in the court of Murad II. And he kept control of his empire through endless force and violence. He ruled with ruthlessness and cruelty those who did not obey him. Now, being a hostage meant you were treated very, very well. You know, it wasn't a bad thing at all. You were educated there. He didn't become a Muslim or anything, but he was educated there, and he was treated as a royal. But he did see everything that the Sultan did to stay in power for 5 years. Insurrections against the Ottoman Empire were constant, and rebels were crushed with public executions. He never converted to Catholicism. By the way, that's a separate issue. Was Vlad the Impaler a Catholic? He was Orthodox. There are some sources that say that Vlad III went over to Catholicism because of his association with the Hungarians and several popes. But according to the Russian diplomat Fyodor Kuritsin, Dracula spent many years in the dungeon. He refused to convert to Catholicism once he was also imprisoned by the Hungarians, despite King Matthias' numerous efforts. He tried to bribe him to becoming a Catholic. He was eventually set free. Russian chronicler suggests that Dracula had converted to Catholicism in return for his freedom, but there really isn't a whole lot of direct evidence for that. The other one, other brother, it wasn't just Vlad, it was also Radu. And Vlad's eldest brother, Mircea, as well as their father, were murdered after John Hunyadi, regent governor of Hungary, invaded Wallachia in 1447. That's when Hunyadi installed Vlad's second cousin, Vladislav II, as Noi Voivod there. Hunyadi launched a military campaign against the Ottomans in the fall of 1448. And Vladislav was there. Eventually, Vlad, that is to say, Vlad II, was driven out and had to seek refuge in the within the confines of the Ottoman Empire. And Hungary was just as complicated as any place else. Vlad III, once he was he was released because he knew that he was the only person who could unify Wallachia. Vlad invaded Wallachia with Hungarian support. And he began a purge among the Wallachian oligarchs to strengthen his position, no differently than Ivan IV did. And if you've studied this topic, you've come across the Transylvanian Saxons. Nothing against the Saxons, but this was a purely oligarchic merchant order that could not handle any actual royal rule. And they supported his opponents. Don, that's D-A-N, that's not Daniel, that's just Don. And Basarab, who were Vladislav's brothers. So Vlad had to plunder the Saxon villages, taking captured people to Wallachia, and executing several. It's from there, and it's from these oligarchs, these German oligarchs, where the stories about Vlad began, after his death, began to take shape. No one called him the Impaler until decades later, coming from these sources. The truth is, Transylvanian Saxons were angry. He strengthened the borders of Wallachia. He was a Romanian nationalist. That meant that they couldn't control the trade routes anymore. And that's where, even just for that, the Saxons distributed all kinds of disgusting poems of cruelty and other propaganda. Maybe some of them had something to do with the drinking of blood. You had a lot of vampiric fiction, but that's mostly a modern phenomenon, in particular, of course, in Germany. The Ottoman Sultan, Mehmed II, ordered Vlad III to pay homage to him personally, but just like in the Sparta movie, he had the Sultan's two envoys captured and impaled. In 1462, he attacked Ottoman territory, successfully, actually. But there's something else that complicates the matter. Radu, Vlad's younger brother, was there for much longer than Vlad III was in Istanbul. He was there for quite some time. Eventually, he became very close to the Sultan himself. Radu, as far as anyone knows, was an actual Muslim. Vlad attempted to, well, we'll talk about this here in a little bit, the daring night raid of June 16th, 1462. But because there was such a huge disparity between Vlad III and Radu and the Turks, many of Vlad's forces deserted and went over to the others. So Vlad had no choice but to seek assistance from Hungary, Matthias Corvinus. And that's when Corvinus had him in prison. I know, this is very complicated. Hopefully I'll straighten it out here. Vlad III, Dracula, became ruler of Wallachia in a brutal time. He was a 10th ruler in 50 years. He had many people who didn't like him. He had support from he had support from others in Transylvania. But he took the Ottoman strategies and put them into practice, destroying anyone who opposed him. Well, I'm sure what choice he had. It was a constant purge of the Wallachian oligarchy, invading Transylvania, plundering border villages. This was a continuous matter. And the impaling, it had been done before. There's actually another monarch also called the Little Impaler in Wallachia. Talk about him in a little bit. But the use of impalement was done. Ivan the Terrible used it sometimes. It was meant as a message. But that was only for the worst of the worst. The Germanic Transylvanian spread rumors about all the worst possible things, that he drank the blood of his victims. And in German-speaking areas, it cemented Vlad III's place, not in history, but in mythology. But by 1462, he vanquished all of his opponents. Now, there was a new sultan, Mehmed the Conqueror, who couldn't believe that he was functioning alone, demanded then that you come and pay homage to him personally. This is something that his father had done many years before, and it ended with all of them under Turkish control. Him as a hostage, and his father was a puppet. Truth is that Dracula realized that the new sultan did intend to ambush and imprison him. He wasn't going to live there. This wouldn't be the Gilded Cage anymore. In February of that year, he attacked Ottoman territory in Bulgaria. Now, the records say slaughtering tens of thousands of Ottoman occupiers by impalement. I don't know how you do that. That's a lot of work to do that. Tens of thousands? That's a lot of big sticks. That was reserved for the worst of the worst. This is an exaggeration. The Sultan still wanted to place a new leader in Wallachia. Again, very, substantial part of the, it was large, relatively speaking, on the Black Sea. And who did he want to put on the throne but Radu? He was known as Radu the Beautiful, or as Radu the Handsome. Radu had been in that hostage situation for so long as a boy. He knew the new Sultan when he was a boy. So they almost grew up together. He did convert to Islam, as I've said. He was trusted very much. Radu stood beside Mehmed at the fall of Constantinople. He was only 23 within the Islamic Janissary Corps when Mehmed's army moved against Vlad III. Now, Vlad couldn't defeat him in open warfare. There was no way. So this is a very early manifestation of guerrilla warfare. Brief, blitzkrieg attacks on Islamic forces. Probably the first in Europe. One of the things that Dracula is criticized for is, or Vlad III, is burning his own crops, diverting streams, creating swamps, poisoning wells, sending livestock to the mountains, which meant that when the army arrived, the Turks had absolutely nothing to eat or drink. And allegedly, and I take this with a huge grain of salt, that Vlad Dracu sent people with leprosy and tuberculosis and the bubonic plague, sent into combat to infect the invaders. That has not been confirmed. I don't know how true that is. But the Turks advanced nonetheless, and Vlad III had to switch tactics. And this is the night raid. This was something brand new, had never been done before. June 17th, 1492, the Sultan had an army of 100,000 men settled near their encampment of Vlad's capital, Ovistia. It's going to come up again and again. Dracula knew how to dress as a Turk. He could speak the language, no problem. He had no problem, moving around. He then located the Sultan's heavily guarded tent, and that was it. He left. He knew where the Sultan was and said, okay, tomorrow we strike. The cover of darkness was absolutely essential. So with that intelligence that Vlad III himself created or found, discovered, cover of darkness, a few thousand horsemen stormed into the encampment, and the only reason was to kill the Sultan himself. The Battle of the Torches, sometimes it's called. It was pure chaos and carnage. No one expected it. It was not normal for the era. Turks were cut down in huge numbers. They were not expecting any of this. Horses, camels, everything else. Unfortunately, Vlad III, Draku, went into the wrong tent. Either that or he had been known and he had switched tents. His plan was thwarted. But he had done some damage, at least psychologically. Now, this is where he eventually becomes known as the Impaler. Because the following day, the Ottoman army marched on his capital, Chagovishte. And that's where they saw essentially a ghost city. Roughly 10,000 Muslim fighters imposed and impaled on stakes, including Hamza Pasha, one of the Sultan's governors. At the same time, Dracula, Vlad III, had fled Wallachia and taken refuge in Transylvania in the mountains to continue his guerrilla warfare against Islam. Vlad was born in 1431, died in 1476. There's a lot of controversy even about his mother. But we know who his father was. His mother was a noblewoman. Vlad was married three times. First to a noblewoman from Transylvania, Princess Bathory. Not the same Bathory, don't even think about it. Then to Justina Szilagyi from Moldova, and then to a cousin of Matthias Corvinus. He had five children, Radu and Vlad from his first, Mihail and Malhina from his second, and Zeliska from his third. And during his reign, Wallachia temporarily gained independence from the Ottomans. Other than that, what you hear about him comes from the oligarchs. Same thing for Ivan IV in Russia. He was only 17 when he, supported by Turkish cavalry and a contingent of troops lent to him by Pasha Mustafa Hasan, took the first steps towards conquering the Wallachian throne. But he was defeated there. He eventually would reject, of course, his Turkish connections. First thing he did once he finally got in on his own was to destroy the oligarchic class who hated him and to personally kill his father's murderer. Easter Sunday, 1459, he arrested the major oligarchic, the heads of the major oligarchic families. And many of them were simply driven out. He, in fact, created his own nobility, an actual nobility, on top of that. An oligarchy was not going to be tolerated. He was no longer connected with the Turks at all. He refused to pay the tribute, which is, at the time, 10,000 gold coins annually. One of the reasons he did it, of course, is that he thought he had Hungarian backing. And one supported by the Pope at the time. Again, the King of Hungary, Corvinus. He actually received from the Pope the sum of 40,000 gold coins, which was roughly enough to equip 15,000 men and a few warships. And the war that followed, so much of the country was devastated. He took the fortress of Nicopolis, 20,000 Turks were killed in that battle. He even mentions that in a letter that Vlad III wrote. But of course, in response, the Turks seemingly, accordingly, you know, at least if you're Wallachian, had massive and almost unlimited resources. The number of men here is only the second largest. It's second only to the army that conquered Constantinople. About 150 warships to destroy all the sea batteries. What did the Wallachians have? If I'm being really generous, 25,000. There was a marine attempt to stop the Turks on the Danube. That had something to do with the night raid and everything else. So the only thing he really could do was function as a guerrilla army. Poison wells, all this stuff. A Turkish detachment goes out looking for food, which there was very little. He attacked there. That attack, as I mentioned before, the middle of the night, it didn't succeed in a military sense. It succeeded psychologically. It was a huge demoralization factor. He didn't get the tent right. Sure, there was a million tents there, and the viziers looked very similar to the emperor himself, or the sultan himself. It was a huge psychological victory. Many Turks were killed. No one was ready for this. The sultan secretly left the camp in shame. He lost so many men there. Then he ordered a retreat. And then, of course, he saw this forest of dead Turks. And his response was, "We can't take a country from a man like this." The attack in the middle of the night didn't cause significant damage. It created panic and a total distrust of the Turkish leadership. And everywhere the Sultan seemed to go, there were groups of impaled Turkish prisoners. It was for the psychological element, not actually for the person being impaled. And he was messing with the Sultan's mind. You know, he'd be marching in a certain spot, he would see 15, a little bit down the road he'd see 20. Almost like he thought he was seeing things. Still, this was, believe it or not, a defeat of the Turks. No one wanted to fight with a guy that was going to do this. Because the Sultan had left. After that, what happened in Wallachia was absolutely brutal. It was just, nothing was stable. It was a very unstable place to begin with. You had Radu the Handsome on the one side and Vlad on the other. And it shouldn't surprise you that Radu the Handsome, who some, you know, thought he was like a Richard Simmons, although maybe not, he had no problem with oligarchy. In fact, he went to all of the enemies of Dracula. He went to the oligarchs, anyone who had a problem with him. He was abandoned by those with money, which can be a problem. He could have achieved victory, even with a small number of men. But Vlad played it cool. In October of 1462, he went to Transylvania to meet with Mate Corvin. Corvin rejected him, rejected his methods, and rejected any kind of plan that he had. He didn't have that many men, and Radu and the Turks clearly controlled the field. Now, there was a forged letter from Vlad to the Sultan. The Wallachian prince was begging forgiveness and assist against the Hungarian armies. There's no doubt in my mind that that's a forgery. Someone wrote it. His enemies, he had many enemies. That's why he was in prison, as I mentioned before, in Hungary. He was released eventually in 1475 at the request of Stephen the Great, who was the Prince of Moldova, because everyone, well, not just him, but we can't have a guy like that in prison. He's a masterful tactician. He's a little loony. But these are insane times. The Dracula thing really, you know, it bugs me a bit. There's a book out in Romanian by Radu Florescu, In Search of Dracula, The History of Dracula and Vampires, which says that there is really no connection between those two. And our opinion of him, it's kind of like, you know, what happened with Ivan the Terrible or Rasputin. Our enemies seem to be masters of propaganda. Oligarchies, almost by their structure, because they rule in secret, are very good at propaganda. Now, Wallachia was just one of the three principalities, the other two being Transylvania and Moldavia. And they will eventually, in the 19th century, unify as united principalities, and they'll eventually become Romania. They spoke the same language, but at the time were separate entities. Radu the Handsome will be his successor on the throne. He stayed, as I said, he stayed there longer. Vlad III was freed until 1448. His brother voluntarily stayed until 1462. But there's no question that he mastered what he saw around him practically as a kid. The Turks released him after informing him of his father's death in 1447, assassinated on the orders of Vladislav II. Also, his older brother, Mircea, was killed. He eventually took revenge on that. But how did Vlad the Impaler see Wallachia? He saw it as the last outpost, the last defense of Christianity on the Danube front. When he was in power, like roughly 20 years, something like that, he had to do what Ivan the Terrible did in Russia. He couldn't allow the oligarchs to trade with just anybody. The oligarchs around Southern Europe were trading with the Turks, no problem. And they were profiting from selling things to the Turks. That couldn't be the case anymore. Now, these Saxon detractors from Transylvania came up with stories that he flayed, boiled, beheaded, blinded, strangled, chopped, nailed, buried alive, wood chipper, all manner of things, most of which were invented. Cutting off noses, ears, genitals, all this stuff that would be a huge amount of work. It's nonsense. Impaling was used, well, unless he was really messing with the Turks, and that was after they were killed. Impaling was used in 1457, 1459, and 1460 against the march of the oligarchs, who ignored his trade laws, and the Jews were a part of this. Protecting Wallachia, you know, the merchants were believers in a certain type of free trade. And it was in fact common for prior rulers of Wallachia to receive their support from these wealthy elites, including foreign elites, in Transylvania. He wasn't going to care about that. Now, the stories that came out about him, any crime from lying to theft to murder can be punished by impalement. There's a story of there was a golden cup in plain sight, the central square of Trgovistje. Could be used by thirsty travelers, but it had to remain in the square. It was never stolen and remained almost unused. The point being that people respected the laws to such an extent that even if they really went right in front of them, they wouldn't dare take it. He was the most effective enemy of the Ottoman Empire in the area. He is not this psycho with his enemies. You know, clearly, right now, in academia, he's being depicted as a psychotic because he fought the Turks, he fought the invasion. Now, some brutality certainly was used against the Turks. There's no doubt about that. It's hard to tell whether he impaled these men before or after death. We discussed that during his retreat where he was just kind of messing with his head, and it was very effective. But the primary sources for these horror stories are Saxon in origin. They don't, and they come, they're much later. They had a huge problem with Vlad III. The second and longest period of his rule between 1456 and 1462, he had driven them out. There's a guy out there named Karl Rottel. I don't know much about him, but I found his article on Vlad the Impaler interesting, and here's what he says. Vlad the psychotic lunatic is very much the literary creation of his monastic and Saxon mercantile enemies. While the propaganda offensive against Vlad was itself funded by Vlad's erstwhile Christian enemy, King Matthias I of Hungary. Vlad was no angel. Now, he certainly executed or impaled his enemies in significant numbers. No one rather doubts he did it personally as often, but one rather doubts what he did personally as often alleged. One suspects that he left that side of affairs to his special execution units, the Armas, which did the majority of the killing in Vlad's reign. But still, Vlad was fighting for his very survival against an enemy he knew very, very, very well. He had grown up as a princely hostage for his father's good behavior in the Ottoman court and was given the best Islamic religious and military education. Vlad's motivation to fight was his strong Christian, simply Orthodox faith, much like that of Ivan the Terrible of Russia, who lived a century after Ivan's death. And I've said before, there are clear connections between those two. They're both lied about beyond belief, and they both realized that the oligarchs internally were just as wicked as their enemies abroad. They were both highly intelligent men. They made use of, for example, innovative military engineering. They were ruthless and single-minded. Ivan the Terrible fought a war of offense against the Muslim Tartars and the internal oligarchs. Vlad fought a war of defense against the Muslim Ottoman Empire. But both men also were well aware of their internal instability, this perpetual problem of the two choices every society has. The intriguing and greedy elite, the oligarchs, many of whom were foreign. And of course, things that he saw as a child do play into this. Ivan created his opchina, and I've applauded that when you're dealing with extreme instability, where entire areas of Russia were going to go over to the Poles and convert. He needed a military force that he can trust. Vlad did the same with the Ottomans. Context is everything. But context doesn't do well in popular. There's a million stupid articles out there in English on like 9 facts you didn't know about Ivan the Impaler. Vlad the Impaler. And they're all incredibly stupid. Both of these men were fighting brutal enemies that they knew very well. And they were extremely popular men. At least as far as Vlad is concerned, he fought both Muslims and Jews. The same ferocities he dealt with domestic traitors. Jews were a significant part of Islamic expansion. There's no doubt about that. I've talked about that in many other places. Firstly, you know, the reason for this is, you know, the Jews have been working with the forces of Islam to facilitate an Islamic takeover. As the Jews were very dominant in many fields within the Sultan, within in the capital. And the Turks were very interested in giving over the money lending and tax farming as a monopoly to the Jews. Christian states weren't doing that. Well, except maybe for the Poles, but that was a little later. They saw Islam as their own creation. Of course, there are going to be Jews in Wallachia because it's on the Black Sea. But when Vlad took over, they fled to the Ottoman Empire. And they were taken with no worry at all, like they belong there. So the oligarchs, whether it be German or Jewish, they're seen as one group of people. Internally and then externally, you had this massive empire that was defeating all comers. His innovative, and I put that in quotes, ways of dealing with the Sultan were effective. He had no choice but either to give it over, give the country over to the Turks, his father did, or build a cohesive force of a large size to combat the huge armies that the Turks were going to deploy against them. In fact, Vlad created the first professional army there. Before that, it was the noble muster, the so-called feudal war bands. Of course, the oligarchs were very much against that, but he did it anyway. Trade controls, we mentioned that already. Controls over usury and debt. We couldn't have, you know, this our enemies growing in power. He created a nationalist economic policy that favored his own people, not foreign merchants and Jewish moneylenders. At the same time, creating a classic professional popular army based on the nation and the Romanian language, not an orthodoxy. The same author, Carl Riedel, he quotes a lot of other scholars who just despise Vlad the Impaler. And he talks about him this way. There was a paper by Badelli and Woods, two so-called scholars. This leads Badelli and Woods to assert that Vlad was a racist of the Hitler type. By the way, if you're still saying stuff like that, a racist of the Hitler, imagine how void your brain has to be. It's such a, I dare say, a boomer thing to say. But it shows how few ideas there are in your head. A racist of the Hitler type. How many people get called that? I mean, is that really the extent of their creativity? Anyway, but while their hysterical tone about Vlad's simple common sense is amusing, it suggests rather pointedly that they don't actually have any substantial criticism of Vlad other than racism. Such pseudo-intellectual prima donnas are hardly worth even rebutting. That could be done by simply asking, what should Vlad have done? Allow his people to be butchered, enslaved, or converted to Islam? Apparently so. They shouldn't have, and not only should have done that, but thank the Ottoman Sultan for being so condescendingly gracious as to murder, enslave, and convert the Wallachians, and not to say the Italians. Fortunately, ordinary Romanians have a far saner view of Vlad and see him as a great national hero who resisted the forces of Islam and their Jewish associates to the bitter end. You know, I started off talking about the fall of Constantinople and the defeat of the Crusades to give an impression of what people were thinking in Europe at the time concerning the Turks, concerning Islam, the Depression, and the fact that you still had kings and princes and mercenaries all still, you know, working for the Turks, including Vlad's father, because he was frightened of something. It makes it all the more outrageous. So Vlad began a campaign of guerrilla warfare. He launched a marine campaign against the Turks on the Danube. About 38,000 of the Turkish forces were destroyed. When the emissaries refused to take off their turbans in front of him, Vlad ensured that these guys would remain with them, ordering nails to be driven into their heads. Very much a "this is Sparta" kind of thing. That was all part of the refusal to pay any... they went to him very much like in that movie, and in reality, saying that we have so much to offer you. We'll give you far more than just Wallachia if you just come over like your father did. But rather than pay tribute and give his men over and himself over like his father did, he was defiant, despite the fact that Mehmed's army was massive compared to that of Wallachia, and he had enemies everywhere. So once the Sultan heard about the two envoys having their turbans nailed to their head because they wouldn't take them off, he said, "This guy has to be dealt with once and for all." And of course, we've talked about this. 1462, he had no choice but to retreat, of course, and using his methods, poisoning the wells and burning. He burned his own village to make sure that the Turks couldn't find anything. And that's why in the winter of 1462, he was able to achieve victory. When the exhausted Sultan reached the capital, he was confronted with that sight. 20,000 Turkish POWs, the forest of the stakes, as I mentioned before, and the terror that that created in him. So, after withdrawing, Mehmed placed Radu the Handsome on the Wallachian throne. And as the head of the Turkish army or the Turkish garrison in the area, the peasants, wherever Vlad's forces, because they were doing guerrilla warfare, they had to hide. The peasants were always in support of him. He had to get out of a fortress. Peasants, like for example, from the village of Arifu, to get to Transylvania, or to escape wherever. They supported him because he didn't give in. But wherever he went, he seemed to be placed under arrest. Either the Turks, of course, wanted to kill him, or, ultimately convert him. And the Hungarians arrested him and put him in prison for a while, as I mentioned before. And, of course, the Saxons who wanted to kill him. But eventually, his last time as Prince of Wallachia was in 1475, very short reign. He was assassinated. This is the main story. The end of December 1476, his body was beheaded, and his head was sent to the Sultan, who placed it on a stake as proof of his triumph over Vlad III the Impaler. Now, some people have said that he was buried at the Snagov Monastery on an island near Bucharest, but there are examinations that show that at Vlad's so-called grave, there's a few horse bones from the Neolithic period, that there's nothing human there at all. There's a few scholars now that say that his body, or pieces of him, are at the site of the Kamana Monastery, which he founded. It all comes down to the fear and the bravery that someone has to have in leading a small country with enemies everywhere, inside and out. What were his options? Only a strong, centralized rule could even possibly give a possibility of victory. His political theory was very clear. He wrote to the people of Brasov in his work against the oligarchs, "Only a strong and powerful ruler can obtain the peace he desires. When he is powerless, a stronger one will come upon him and do with him what he pleases." The Byzantine historian Leonic Sassocondyl writes that, quote, "This man completely transformed the organization of Dacia," of course the Greek term for the area, that's Wallachia. But centralizing power, that was pretty normal at the time. Here's what that Byzantine historian mentioned. "When he came to power, he first formed a personal guard that was inseparable from him, then calling one by one his boyars, he could believe to be capable of taking part in treason for the change of lords. He served them and impaled them, along with the whole house, himself, children, women, and servants. In order to strengthen his rule, it seems, he killed 20,000 men, women, and children in a short time. Surrounding himself with a number of soldiers, he gave them the money and wealth of the murdered so that in a short time, he reached the radical change that this man completely transformed the organization of Dacia. And peons, not a few of whom he believed had some involvement in public affairs, sparing none of them, he killed in very large numbers." Now the word peon is interesting. It's used in the Greek text. I don't know where he's getting his information here. There's no evidence that he would kill women and children. That doesn't make any sense. It's possible that peons refer to Hungarians, but he would only use impaling for the absolute worst offenders. And sometimes it would be after death. But they also could have been the Saxon merchants from Transylvania. In which case, the Byzantine Chronicle, he was being very vague. This is a very unflattering portrait. I just wonder if his information is coming from the wrong sources. But all of this was to build a force against the Ottoman Empire. He built the largest army he could possibly get together of all men capable of bearing arms. And of course, the personal guard, as we mentioned before, the Ottomans. He didn't have tons of financial resources. He didn't really have anything. So he couldn't afford mercenaries. So the main forces of his army were his own princely servants. So the same military, though it was a militarized administration of the country in peacetime, it was the same group of people. His military policy was like Stephen the Great from Moldova. And he said, if Vlad had a larger army, as I mentioned before, it might have created a great power. He enjoyed a reputation in Europe, manifested an abundant literary production, spread since years after his death. He was complex, he was strong, he was a great man. The King of Hungary encouraged the dissemination in Europe of so-called German narratives, that's the Saxon merchant narratives, that sought to compromise the Wallachian ruler due to the harsh measures he took against them, because clearly the Hungarian monarchy was connected to them. A lot of absurdities, acts of cruelty, all of these very expensive tortures with no explanation. And it's very suspicious when you have a total lack of motive. That means that Vlad was just a man who wanted to satisfy his criminal instincts, not build the state. But that's clearly not the case. You see this in a lot of atrocity porn, a lot of atrocity propaganda. With a name like Vlad the Impaler, now it's kind of easy to associate him with terrible things. But again, he used this only in times of extreme stress to deal with points of extreme corruption, betrayal, and external attacks. Yeah, it was done. It's well documented. It was either that or anarchy. The same thing goes for Ivan IV. He was harsh, but he had no choice. Again, my support for the Taliban in Afghanistan. They're building a war-torn, totally impoverished PTSD country. What else can they possibly do than create a very harsh system of rules? A country constantly under pressure from the Ottomans, other Balkan enemies. I think he wasn't going to implement drastic measures. How dare these professors in their comfortable offices condemn him? I can only imagine what it's like to be in his position. Impalement was done as a symbol of his power and his desire to punish traitors. And he certainly was not ruthless towards his own subjects. He was very careful about maintaining internal order. He fought theft, corruption, injustice, those who broke the law. They could be severely punished. But there was no sadism involved. It was harsh because of the environment. He was an autocrat because there was no other option. He enforced the law in any way that was perceived by most of the population as just and necessary. The poetry of the era seems to show that, just like Ivan the Terrible. His subjects generally viewed him as a protector against thieves, invaders, and those who sought to destabilize the country, because once he was gone and the Turks took over, these acts of violence began to increase. He is a central figure in Romanian history, and he's important now because of the invasion of some of these same people, just not a military invasion, of Central and Western Europe. I'm very proud of my Irishmen who are protesting over and over. I mean, I don't even know how you protest over there when the tiniest little thing could be perceived as some ethnic insult. You know, they were chanting, throw them out or something. You know, given what Sven Longshanks was put in prison for, what would that be? And of course, that's the whole point of it, to get people to stay home and eventually be so overwhelmed by these people that you don't say anything ever again. I should note that there was Basarab IV. His name was the Little Impaler. 1444 to 1482. Again, very similar. Four times the voivode, the Principality of Wallachia. Between 1474 and 1482. Again, the same kind of instability. So he was not the only guy in Wallachia who was called the Impaler. There was at least one other. You know, the princes there normally were elected by the boyars, or the landowning nobles. But the house of Basarab was split into two factions. The Mercia's descendants and the descendants of Don, as I mentioned before. The dynasty. Mircea had a son named Vlad II, born around 1390. What we talked about before. Sigismund himself, actually the founder of the Order of the Dragon, made him governor of Transylvania. The only thing that was going to fix this, with few financial resources, not a whole lot of people, internal enemies, external enemies, is to mobilize the best of your people, the best you can, to be very harsh. There is simply no other way. He was a great strategist. He was an incredible leader. He was congratulated both by Orthodox prelates and Catholic popes for his imposition of law and order. Now, it's bad enough that he had the enemies that he did. You also had the oligarchy of Venice that's going to support oligarchies everywhere else. The Venetians, you know, I've been talking about this for a long time, were trading with the Turks long before Constantinople fell. The Venetians said, we're not going to act against the Turks unless there's this huge alliance. Which, in other words, we're not going to do anything unless, you know, because we're making a substantial profit from them. The Council of Mantua later on, 1459, Venice actually had the gall to request, in exchange for participation in any kind of anti-Ottoman coalition, the payment of all war expenses, dispatch of 8,000 people to equip its vessels, and the organization of an army of 50,000 horsemen and 20,000 footmen that was supposed to go to Hungary. Paid for by someone else. This is why the crusade of Pope Pius II went nowhere. The Danube is often a forgotten front in the war against Islam. Beyond that, you had complications in Central Europe, which involved Hungary, German Emperor Frederick III of Habsburg, to the guardianship exerted on his nephew, Ladislaus V, the Hungarian king, aimed to annex Austria, Styria, Carinthia, Hungary, and even Czechia, thus creating an empire capable of, you know, building a force against his enemies. But when Matthias Corvinus came to the throne, it changed all of that. But Frederick III was elected king of Hungary with the help of a strong internal oligarchic party. So there was an idea, a conception of an anti-Ottoman alliance, but actually no functionality. But when you read the official chronicles from Wallachia, Hungary, even the Turkish, you read between the lines, this is just a classic medieval ruler who needed to secure his throne that was rightly his and impose justice and discipline in a country that didn't have it for a while. But when you try to connect him with Dracula, the bloodsucker, he was drinking blood because that was part of the propaganda. Massacres he ordered against civilians for no reason, women and children. There were no slaughter of women and children. The concept of impaling his enemies was done for a psychological purpose. He was sending a message, and it was a very successful. He was not putting women and children there. Overwhelmingly, these were traitors. These were oligarchs. These were Turkish POWs, many of whom were killed beforehand. It didn't matter. It's just the view, this forest of spikes that forced the Turks back. They were so taken by it all. Calling him ruthless is not a value judgment. Anyone in his position would have to do the same kind of thing. And it was successful. As far as it went, he terrified the Turks with his use of the impalement. It actually got to them. It was one of the reasons that the Sultan, you know, freaked out. He left. He retreated. He did take losses in his attack in the middle of the night and a few others. You know, constant guerrilla attacks. But he didn't have to retreat. He said, "Who is this guy? This is the prince of Wallachia doing this?" Yes, historical records are scarce, often unreliable. It's challenging to determine the number of casualties during Vlad's rule. I've seen a bunch. Impaling, maybe 10,000 over, 20 years, 25 years? But we all know why Vlad the Impaler is despised by our enemies. He's despised by the historical establishment and why he's still important today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk again to you guys next week. Bye-bye.